and humiliation she suffered at home, only about Dutch racism. I think now that this obsession with identifying racism, which I saw so often among Somalis too, was really a comfort mechanism to keep people from feeling personally inadequate and to externalize the causes of their unhappiness. Naima was right about one thing. It didn't seem fair to expect the same from her as from my Dutch schoolmates, who had nothing to do except study and worry about whether people liked them enough. Her circumstances were so much less nurturing. I would read psychology books all afternoon and then look up at Hawea on the sofa. She seemed like an object case of every kind of neurosis there was. All psychology students feel this way about their flatmates, but not all of them are clumsy enough to say so. I did, though. I was always telling Hawea what I thought was wrong with her. I also told her she should stop therapy with Jose. I thought my friend Hanneke would be a far better choice. Hawea felt assaulted by all of this. She felt that I was implying that she had some kind of mental illness. She switched counselors, but she thought Hanneke was too shallow to understand her. Soon after she began seeing her, Hawea stopped going to therapy at all. After that, she became impossible to live with. She stopped attending school and would sit all day on the couch, watching television, day and night, letting dishes pile up in the sink. Her dirty clothes were strewn on the floor. Sometimes she would barely look up when I came in. She used to cry for days about the way she had mistreated Ma and how she would burn in hell for it. Ma had not wished her goodbye, and Hawea had left telling her, "I hate you. From now on, you are no longer my mother." I sympathized with Hawea, but we quarreled. I couldn't stand the way she was living, lying on the sofa all day like some vacant life form. One time I got so angry I pulled the TV plug out of the wall and kicked the TV down the stairs. Hawea just stared at me, then locked the front door shut against me. She wouldn't let me back in, though I pleaded. I was barefoot and it was cold outside, but I ended up walking to Johanna and Martin's house. Johanna and Martin had been telling me for a long time that Hawea and I should stop living together. They knew how much we bickered, and they thought I was looking after Hawea too much, destroying my chances of doing well in school. They drove me home, and Johanna laid down the law to Hawea. She should move out. Hawea liked the idea. There was a one-room apartment available in a building near where Ellen and Hanneke lived, 10 minutes away by bicycle. We joked that this way no one would bother her about doing the dishes. We could invite each other over. Johanna lent Hawea the money to pay the guarantee on the flat. Martin helped us move and built her new furniture. After Hawea moved out, she went back to language school. She seemed to take charge of her life again. We saw each other often in the beginning. She seemed to crave my company. It was almost as if we could be more friendly now that we were slightly apart. A Dutch girl moved into my flat. Life became more peaceful. In May 1995, Sylvia, the social worker at the Asylum Seekers Center, persuaded me to try to become an official Somali-Dutch interpreter. She said my Dutch was far better than most of the official interpreters she worked with, and the work paid well. The immigration service paid its interpreters 44 guilders an hour plus 22 guilders for time spent in transport compared to the 13 guilders an hour I earned at the biscuit factory. I was still attending vocational college at the time, but Sylvia said translating would be ideal. I could do it in my free time after school. I went to the immigration service headquarters in Zwolle and applied. They tested my Dutch, though not my Somali, and said I could try out the job for a couple of months and they would see how it went. They suggested I get a pager. Everyone at college thought I was so cool when the pager beeped and I had to rush off to a phone. I bought myself some professional clothes, a black knee-length skirt, a long tailored shirt, and some pumps. My first job was to translate for a Somali asylum seeker at a police station. For me, it was a momentous occasion. It was just like my own experience asking for asylum, only now, less than 3 years later, my position had changed completely. The asylum seeker was a Darod man, with a little beard and ankle-length trousers. When I came in, he scrutinized me and asked, "Are you the translator?" When I said yes, he sneered at me. He said, "But you're naked. I want a real translator." So I translated that, and the Dutch civil servant told the man, "I decide who translates. You don't." The atmosphere had suddenly shifted from my own courteous tea and coffee. It was all business. The Darod man tried to find out my ancestry, who I was, but the civil servant put a stop to it. Neither of them even looked at me while the interview went on. I was just a part of the process like a typewriter. I found this soothing. Although the Somali man's contempt bothered me, I knew I must learn to control my emotions if I was to become a professional. This was my work, a simple transaction, no different from packing boxes at a factory. And anyway, he needed me. Afterward, the policeman handed me a form with the time I had worked and the amount I would earn all filled in. I walked out, thrilled. My next assignment was in a reception center in Schalkhar. I would be interpreting for a Gala woman who had lived near Afgoye. The Hawiya fighters had taken her and put her with other Gala women in a compound. They were there to be raped, although they also were made to cook and clean and get firewood for the soldiers. Telling her story, this woman began shaking. She spoke in small, short, quiet sentences, and as I tried to pass them on, I couldn't control my tears. I said to the civil servant, who was a woman, "I know I'm messing up. I've only just started working, and I'm so sorry. I just need to take a minute to wash my face." But when the Dutch woman looked at me, I saw she was crying too. The girl's story was so horrible. She had become pregnant and given birth. The baby was always with her. Then one night, one of the Hawiya soldiers picked the baby off her and threw it in the fire. He forced her to watch as the child burned. She was thin. She said she was 28 or 29, but she looked over 50. She kept talking about all the other Gala women with whom she had been kept captive. She had escaped when another Hawiya subclan took over the compound. She didn't know what had happened to the others. 2 months later, I went back to Schalkhar for another job. That same civil servant caught sight of me and rushed over to tell me that the Gala woman had been given refugee status. We smiled and congratulated each other. Still, by then I knew how many others failed to get asylum in Holland. There are so many different kinds of suffering in this world. Many times, while I was working as an interpreter, I wished someone would give these people a chance, especially the women, who could really make something of their lives here. But I knew when I was translating a story that would not qualify the person as a refugee. I translated for men who had killed, who were clearly soldiers. I even translated for a man who was a notorious torturer in the Gotka, Siad Barre's torture center in Mogadishu. Now family members of the people he had tortured were hunting him down. I didn't say anything. I was just the interpreter. I don't know if he got in. At the end of June, I took my first year finals at the vocational college and I passed. I had a propedeuse. Now I could claim my right to attend the oldest and finest university in Holland, the University of Leiden. Chapter 13. Leiden. I could study political science in just three universities, Amsterdam, Nijmegen, or Leiden. In Nijmegen, the courses didn't interest me. It was all public administration, land use and waterways, and social geography. Amsterdam appeared chaotic. I had heard that students marked their own exams and demanded equality with professors. But Leiden, Holland's oldest university, had rigorous standards. And when I visited the old city with the tiny canals and flocks of students careering around on bicycles, I wanted with all my heart to be a part of it. Leiden was so pretty, it was like walking through an illustration from the Ladybird books of fairy tales with which I had learned English in Nairobi. Houses had long-necked bell towers, stepping-stone roofs, and, curiously, tiny, twisted staircases that I had always found so perilous to navigate, each little step much thinner than your foot. Every staircase made me feel more foreign, yet I marveled at this dollhouse of a city. So midway through my year at the vocational college, I had applied to Leiden. That was not a happy experience. The woman at the desk told me she was legally obliged to register my application, but made it clear that she thought it most unwise. She sent me to talk to the dean of students, who also seemed dubious. She told me I would do far better to return to vocational college and complete my 3-year social work course there. It would qualify me for a real job right away. I might fail a degree in political science in Leiden. It was perhaps too abstract to be useful. Better to stay where I was. It might suit me better. I told her I wanted to apply anyway. I was determined to try, at least. Now that I had my proper d'oeuvre, the condition for my entry, I could begin classes in Leiden. Almost immediately, I was swamped. The first 3 courses were basic. Introduction to Political Science, Introduction to History, Introduction to Public Administration. There were piles of books to read every week. Books on the art of governance, books about what is a state, books about the history of Holland and Europe. We didn't have to memorize them, but we needed to know the themes, the theories, and this was new. We needed to develop our own opinion. We were always asked what we thought. In spite of everyone telling me what a poor choice political science was, I loved it. To others it might seem dry, but not to me. From birth, I had been fed shards of this story. Democracy, justice, nation, war. Now, with kind and thoughtful teaching, good governance was making sense to me as a process. Something that had grown. European history was a gripping chronicle which began with chaos. Holland came from nothing, mud and poverty and foreign rule. Even the land was constructed by a collective effort. The sea tides roaring over half the country were too powerful to confront individually. So the Dutch learned to be clever and work together. They cut channels through the silt to control the flooding and built new land where the sea had been. They learned to be resourceful and persistent. They learned negotiation. They learned that treason is better than force. Above all, they learned to compromise. Half of Holland was Protestant, half Catholic. In every other European country, that was a recipe for massacre. But in Holland, people worked it out. After a period of oppression and bloodshed, they learned that you cannot win a civil war. Everyone loses. They set up a system so people could be separate and equal. 2 big blocks developed in Dutch society, Protestants and Catholics. Later, a 3rd block developed for Social Democrats, who were both Protestant and Catholic, and there was also a much smaller group of non-religious secular people called the Liberals. These blocks were the pillars, the foundation of Dutch society. These pillars operated just like clans. For generations, Dutch Catholics and Protestants went to separate schools, hospitals, clubs, shops. They even had separate channels on television and separate radio stations. As late as 1995 in Leiden, the pillars at least partly defined who you were and who you knew, as the clans did in Somalia. But here, everything was negotiated and shared out in apparently seamless equanimity. I came to realize how deeply the Dutch are attached to freedom and why. Holland was in many ways the capital of the European Enlightenment. 400 years ago, when European thinkers severed the hard bands of church dogma that had constrained people's minds, Holland was the center of free thought. The Enlightenment cut European culture from its roots in old fixed ideas of magic, kingship, social hierarchy, and the domination of priests, and regrafted it onto a great strong trunk that supported the equality of each individual and his right to free opinions and self-rule, so long as he did not threaten civic peace and the freedom of others. Here in Leiden was where the Enlightenment had taken hold. Here, the Dutch let each other be free, and here, this commitment to freedom took hold of me too. Sometimes I could almost sense a little shutter clicking shut in my brain, so that I could keep reading my textbooks without struggling to align their content with my belief in Islam. Sometimes it seemed as if almost every page I read challenged me as a Muslim. Drinking wine and wearing trousers were nothing compared to reading the history of ideas. People had contested the whole basis of the idea of God's power on earth, and they had done it with reasoning that was beautiful and compelling. Darwin said creation stories were a fairy tale. Freud said we had power over ourselves. Spinoza said there were no miracles, no angels, no need to pray to anything outside ourselves. God was us and nature. Emil Durkheim said humans fantasized religion to give themselves a sense of security. I read all this and then had to try to stuff it all behind the little shutter in my brain. In every way, to read these books of Western history was sinning. Even the history of how modern states formed confronted me with the contradictions of my belief in Allah. The European separation of God's world from the state was itself haram. The Quran says there can be no government without God. The Quran is Allah's book of laws for the conduct of worldly affairs. In February 1995, there were huge floods across Holland. When Somalis are faced with catastrophic weather, drought and flooding, they all get together and pray. Natural disasters are signs from God to show humans they're misbehaving on earth. But the Dutch blamed their government for failing to maintain the dikes properly. I didn't see anybody praying. It was such a strange paradox. In Holland, everything had been founded on people's religion, but the whole nation at its core seemed so ungodly. Here one could, and many did, contest the very existence of God at every turn. People openly disbelieved every aspect of religion. The very shape of Holland seemed like a challenge to Allah. Reclaiming land from the sea, controlling flooding with canals, it was like defying God. Almost everything was secular here. God was mocked everywhere. The most common expletive used in Dutch is Godverdomme. I heard it all the time. God damn me. To me, the worst thing possible, and yet nobody was struck by a thunderbolt. Society worked without reference to God, and it seemed to function perfectly. This man-made system of government was so much more stable, peaceful, prosperous, and happy than the supposedly God-devised systems I had been taught to respect. Sometimes the shutter wouldn't close anymore. I had stuffed too many ideas behind it. I would have an attack of guilt and take stock of myself. The trousers, the hair, the books, the ideas. I would think about Sister Aziza's angels, who were certainly still on my shoulders, watching me, recording it all. I would tell myself weakly that I was pursuing knowledge. If Allah had predetermined everything, He must have foreseen me doing this. I told myself that one day, when I had developed the willpower, when I was back in a Muslim environment, I would find the strength to repent and truly obey God's laws. Meanwhile, I would be honest. I would try not to harm anyone. I would not myself adopt the ideas I was reading about, but I would keep reading them. With the exception of statistics, which I failed repeatedly, I enjoyed every subject at Leiden, particularly political philosophy. Humans have made so many observations. I felt so lucky that I didn't have to think of all of this by myself. It was such a privilege to watch people thinking page after page. Everything in the books was so beautifully put together, so rational. We learned to define, to think clearly about what we were saying, to set out our thinking in building blocks and argue with data. In that way, we improved on older theories and expanded our understanding of the world. Most of those first courses in Leiden stressed the empirical, just the facts. The facts themselves are a beautiful idea. They were about method and reason. There was no place here for emotions and irrationality. Sometimes, reading history or philosophy books, I would actually get goosebumps. I remember this happening when I read the story of the First World War. At the end of the 19th century, science brought industry, wealth, and medicine to Europe. Then as the century turned, countries became suspicious of each other. They formed alliances and stocked arms. They sought power and territory. War broke out, and a whole generation of young men who had just recently escaped from poverty and disease were mowed down in the trenches. People came back to their senses and stopped the war, only to repeat it 20 years later. It was appalling, but also completely gripping to me, like a novel, and it bore so many parallels with what I had known in other countries. When I turned and looked at the kids sitting next to me, they clearly didn't feel the same thrill I did. To them, it was a story they knew by heart already, just another grade. Most of the students in Leiden were 18 years old, and this was their first experience of living away from their parents. All the students in Leiden seemed to be white, with blonde hair and light blue eyes. There were clear clan distinctions among them, however. There were the girls with their hair in stiff little bobs, who wore blue eye makeup and sweaters that said Benetton on them. They were the clones. The girls who coloured their hair and let the roots show were trash, and girls whose hair was oily and unwashed were sleazy. They did drugs. As soon as a girl who looked slightly different left a group of students, the others gossiped about her. Although these girls identified each other by dress and accent, by class, not clan, it was just like being among Somalis, trying to figure out if everyone was Osman Mahmoud, and then all feeling comfortable to talk about the Hawir. Sometimes I would remark during a lesson that something was a class issue. People would always say, "We have no class problems in Holland. We are an egalitarian society." I didn't believe it for a second. Top people sent their children to Leiden, CEOs and people in the government. These children had their own upper-class fraternity, Minerva, within which they divided into old money, the old Dutch nobility, and the nouveau riche. They all gathered in the grand old Minerva student house, and their social lives circulated within the club. Most of them did law or banking. If they were doing social science, they studied government. Political science was apparently considered left-wing. There were all sorts of fraternities. Catena was for non-conformists, kids from intellectual families in Amsterdam who didn't want to go through a week of hazing. They had multiply pierced ears, wore dirty clothes, and organized environmental protests. Quintus was for people who couldn't get into Minerva and wished they had. In my first few weeks, people took me around to these fraternities. When they told me about the degreening week, that's the Dutch phrase for hazing, I told them I had already lost my bloom. I was 25. This was not for me. I had been degreened by life. I wasn't tempted either by the student dorm I visited when I first arrived in Leiden. It was filthy. So I rented a room from a lovely woman, Chantal, who had a big house in the suburbs. I bought a brand new bicycle, which I still have a decade later, and rode it to class every morning. For the first few months, I didn't socialize much. When I wasn't studying, I was working as a translator. I had now registered as a Somali interpreter, and I worked all the time. In the morning, if I didn't have class, I would leave my beeper on. I bought my own phone, so I could be available for phone translations from all over the country until late at night. I was called by police, by hospitals, by law courts, by all kinds of shelters. The worst calls were when I had to break the news to someone that, no, the authorities won't allow your wife and children to come to Holland to be with you. No, We cannot give you the opportunity to go back to Somalia and get your children, even though you've been raped and your husband has been killed and four of your fingers have been cut off. Or I have to inform you that you have HIV/AIDS. Sometimes I would put the phone down in my little room and shake with the feelings I had just translated. One Somali girl lived in an asylum seeker, just as I had, and she had an Ethiopian girlfriend just like me. This Somali girl got in a car with four men. She thought she was meeting her girlfriend at a party. She was raped repeatedly, then ran away from the house and was found in the village, which was when the police called me. I sat in my little room in the attic of Chantal's lovely home and tried to translate what they were telling her. I explained to this girl that she must not wash herself because the sperm and blood that were still trailing between her thighs were evidence. I couldn't ask if she had been infibulated because the rules are you can't insert your own questions and opinions. You're purely a machine. I could only try to calm her down. The girl was completely hysterical. She was frantic that the other people in the asylum seeker would shun her because she was defiled. The policewoman I was translating for had me talk the girl through her story and persuade her to give evidence. She told her that in 6 months they would give her an HIV test if she wanted one. I asked the policewoman if it would be possible to have her transferred to another refugee center so there would be no shame. She agreed. The girl grew calmer. I put the phone down, blown to pieces by this horrible world, and then I had to walk downstairs to have dinner with Chantal. There could not have been a greater contrast with her tidy, gentle, pleasant life. Sometimes it was hard even to talk about what I had been doing. When I told Chantal my stories, she was horrified. She said these things were unheard of in Holland. It didn't occur to me then, but this was also another kind of education. An education in suffering, abuse, pain, misery, and the evils of ignorance. I did abortion clinic translations. If it was a phone translation, then mostly I had to explain to the girl what abortion means. Translate a few questions. Does the father know? Have you thought about keeping the baby? I knew the form by heart. Then when I put the phone down, I would know that this girl would now have an abortion, and I had been instrumental in this sinful act. I would stuff it all behind the shutter in my brain and go on to my next class or appointment. Sometimes I would have to go to the abortion clinic and explain to the girl that because her scar was still almost completely closed up, she would have to have complete anesthesia to cut it open and remove the baby. The girl would always be horrified and insist, "Then you must resaw me afterward." Mostly the doctors would nod, but they never did it. One young doctor asked me to explain. "It's unnecessary and dangerous for you, and we in Holland don't do these things," he told me to tell the girl. She just cried helplessly. When I went to the awful places, the police stations, the prisons, the abortion clinics and penal courts, the unemployment offices and the shelters for battered women, I began to notice how many dark faces looked back at me. It was not something you could avoid noticing, coming straight in from creamy blonde Leiden. I began to wonder why so many immigrants, so many Muslims, were there. It was particularly striking when I visited women's shelters. Terrible, depressing places. The addresses were supposed to be secret. Perhaps 30 women, but sometimes as many as 100 would live in each shelter, and children ran everywhere in the living space. There were hardly any white women, only women from Morocco, from Turkey, from Afghanistan, Muslim countries, alongside some Hindu women from Suriname. The Somali cases were almost always the same again and again. The husband took all the welfare money, spent it on qaat, and when the wife hit the money he would beat her, until finally the police intervened. One Somali woman was about my age, from a rural area. She couldn't read or write Somali or speak a word of Dutch. She had been married in Somalia to a man who had come to visit looking for a wife and who then brought her straight to Holland. She almost never left the apartment on her own. She was frightened of the foreign streets. Her husband beat her. Finally, the police brought her, horribly bruised and cut, to the women's shelter. This woman was not only homeless in Holland, she could not go back to her family in Somalia either. She told me it was Allah's will. Allah gave me these circumstances, and if I am patient, Allah will remove this misery. Women like this never pressed charges. The prospect of making their way alone seemed to them impossible. They were convinced that by accepting systematic, really merciless abuse, they were serving Allah and earning a place in heaven. They always went back to their husband. I was only a translator, but I absorbed these stories and had to confront the unfairness of it. The social workers would always ask the women, "Do you have family here? Can they help you?" The women would say to me, "But they support my husband, of course. You must obey your husband if you are a Muslim. If you refuse your husband and he rapes you, that's your fault. Allah says husbands should beat their wives if they misbehave. It's in the Quran." This attitude made me angry. I knew that many Dutch women were abused too, but their community and their family didn't approve of it. Nobody blamed them for the violence or told them to obey better. I went to prisons, to the penitentiaries in Rotterdam and The Hague. Mostly they were assault cases. Somalis weren't usually involved in stealing or dealing drugs. But if Somali men disagree, losing their temper and grabbing a weapon is almost second nature. One man had hit his landlord on the head with a hammer when he came to the flat to ask for the rent. Social services sent the man to counseling, but I don't believe there was jail time. I went to remedial schools, schools for children with learning disabilities, schools for the mentally handicapped and the deaf. Once I was called to a school to help a teacher explain to some parents that their 7-year-old was extremely aggressive. If he beat up one more child, he would have to be sent to a special school for aggression treatment. I had trouble even finding the words in Somali to explain what aggression treatment might be. The child told his side of the story. A kid stuck his tongue out at him and called him a bad name, so he beat him up. Doing this was completely congruent with his upbringing. In Somalia, you attack. You hit first. If you wait to be hit, you will only be bullied more. I was taught that too. Having heard the kid's story, the parents said, "See, the other child started it." The teacher, who was a young woman, said, "But this other child didn't hit." And the parents in chorus exclaimed, "You don't wait to be hit." I had to ask to be released from the rule of strict translation so I could explain things. I told the teacher, "Where we come from, aggression is a survival tactic. We teach our children to hit first. You will have to explain more." The teacher looked at me as though I was mad. She explained that if all the children were allowed to hit each other, then it would be survival of the fittest. The strongest would bully the others. And the parents nodded. This satisfied them because they wanted their child to be the strongest. Finally, I said to the parents, "Look, in Holland, if you hit people, then they think something is wrong with you. Here, they solve disagreements by talking. If your son continues to hit, he will be taken to a place where the children are mentally unwell, to be treated for an illness." So then they listened. They made all sorts of agreements and arrangements to meet again. When the meeting ended, all three of them said how illuminating it had been for them to see that such an unusual culture could exist. I cycled home thinking, this is why Somalia is having a civil war and Holland isn't. It was all there. People in Holland agree that violence is bad. They make a huge effort to teach their children to channel aggression and resolve their disputes verbally. They had analyzed conflict and set up institutions to regulate it. This was what it meant to be citizens. I wasn't strong enough to think all these things through just yet. I didn't feel ready to step back and ask myself why so many Muslim immigrants, were violent, on welfare, poor. I just absorbed the facts. But I was beginning to see that Muslims in Holland were being allowed to form their own pillar in Dutch society, with their own schools and their own way of life, just like Catholics and Jews. They were being left politely alone to live in their own world. The idea was that immigrants needed self-respect, which would come from a strong sense of membership in their community. They should be permitted to set up Quranic schools on Dutch soil. There should be government subsidies for Muslim community groups. To force Muslims to adapt to Dutch values was thought to conflict with those values. People ought to be free to believe and behave as they wish. The Dutch adopted these policies because they wanted to be good people. Their country had behaved unspeakably in Indonesia and didn't much resist Hitler. In Holland, a greater percentage of Jews were deported during the Second World War than in any other country in Western Europe. Dutch people felt guilty about this recent past. When massive immigration began in Holland, which wasn't until the 1980s, there was a sense among the Dutch that society should behave with decency and understanding toward these people and accept their differences and beliefs. But the result was that immigrants lived apart, studied apart, socialized apart. They went to separate schools, special Muslim schools, or ordinary schools in the inner city, which other families fled. At the Muslim schools, there were no children from Dutch families. The little girls were veiled and often separated from the boys, either in the classroom or during prayer and sports. The schools taught geography and physics just like any school in Holland, but they avoided subjects that ran contrary to Islamic doctrine. Children weren't encouraged to ask questions and their creativity was not stimulated. They were taught to keep their distance from unbelievers and to obey. This compassion for immigrants and their struggles in a new country resulted in attitudes and policies that perpetuated cruelty. Thousands of Muslim women and children in Holland were being systematically abused, and there was no escaping this fact. Little children were excised on kitchen tables. I knew this from Somalis for whom I translated. Girls who chose their own boyfriends and lovers were beaten half to death or even killed. Many more were regularly slapped around. The suffering of all these women was unspeakable. And while the Dutch were generously contributing money to international aid organizations, they were also ignoring the silent suffering of Muslim women and children in their own backyard. Holland's multiculturalism, its respect for Muslims' way of doing things, was not working. It was depriving many women and children of their rights. Holland was trying to be tolerant for the sake of consensus, but the consensus was empty. The immigrants' culture was being preserved at the expense of their women and children, and to the detriment of the immigrants' integration into Holland. Many Muslims never learned Dutch and rejected Dutch values of tolerance and personal liberty. They married relatives from their home villages and stayed inside Holland in their tiny bubble of Morocco or Mogadishu. I worked every day as an interpreter, before class, after class, on weekends. At night, I translated documents, often reports on children with suspected learning disabilities. The child would be 3 years old, not talking, unable to play with educational toys like blocks and puzzles, did not recognize a pen. The mother would be young, uneducated, barely able to speak Dutch. There were medical reports on battered women or social workers' recommendations that children should be removed from their parents' homes. 25 cents a word made 75 guilders a page. I could easily have quit school and made a very good living as a Somali interpreter for the rest of my life, but I didn't think of it for 1 minute. I was worried about Hawea. While I was picking my way through my textbooks in Leiden, dictionary in hand, Hawea seemed to be falling apart. She could be charming, but her mood swings had become much more intense. They made her seem harsh and hostile, and many people were afraid of her. At first, Hawea's guilt over her abortion seemed natural to me. She told me Allah would never forgive her. She had killed, not once but twice. But then one day, when we went out together, she put on a headscarf. She told me, I have to be careful in this country. It's godless. It will turn us into unbelievers. I said, but Hawea, you were never religious before. She told me it's true, but I need to become religious now because otherwise I risk losing my religion completely. Hawea thought she was going to hell. Perhaps the dissonance between what she saw and what she thought she should believe was so severe that she couldn't stand it. Perhaps she couldn't deal with individual freedom. Perhaps it was simply a reaction to her abortion. At first, I couldn't figure out what was going on. I thought this must be some kind of phase. Hawea began praying every day. She had exactly the same questions as I did. Why was it that Holland could give its people so much better a life than any Muslim country we had seen? But Hawea answered those questions by going back into religion. She started reading Hassan al-Banna and Sayyid Qutb, Islamic thinkers I had once devoured in Nairobi. Hawea had not been in the Brotherhood as I had, or seen the misery I translated every day, and she sought her answers in the Qur'an. To me, seeking answers in the Qur'an had only led to more questions. Once I told her, I don't think you'll find the answers to your questions there. She turned on me. Are you saying Allah doesn't have the answers, and you do? I became confused. I wasn't in any way challenging Allah. I couldn't do that. I told her, look at Holland. It's not perfect, and the Dutch complain a lot, but it's orderly, it's humane, it's prosperous. Everybody seems to be basically happy. And we from Muslim countries are pouring into places like Holland, so you must admit they must be doing something right. If you want to do things as Allah says, then look at Iran. Want to live there? Iran is Shia, Hawea said. So, did you prefer Saudi Arabia? I asked. I say the Quran might be God's truth as a spiritual guide, but it seemed to me that in terms of building governments, it was the godless Western theories that gave better answers. Hawea told me I had become kufr. It had started with the language and the way I dressed, and now it had reached my brain. I was a traitor. She made me feel horribly guilty about the way I had abandoned prayer and my obedience to Allah. She described my Western ideas as a sort of virus that was slowly destroying my moral values. But the more I read Western books, the more I wanted to read them. The more I learned about government, about the development of the individual, about systems of thought like social democracy and liberalism, the one the product of the other, the more I prefer things this way. The concept of individual choice improved people's lives so visibly, as did equality between men and women. I was enamored of the idea that you should think precisely and question everything and build your own theories. I was not blind to the disadvantages of all these freedoms. I felt the loneliness and sometimes even the emptiness of our lives. It was sometimes tiresome to have to find out everything by myself instead of relying on the comfortable, clear lines of doctrine and detailed rules. At times, I too feared the limitless freedoms of Holland. So I understood why Hawea was fleeing into religion, but I saw the joy in living in the West. Here I could satisfy my curiosity. When I felt interested in something, I could try it. And was wiser for that. I could draw my own conclusions. However, I did like the efficiency in Holland, and that she didn't have to pay bribes. She thought it was wonderful to be able to say no. No, thank you, I'm not coming. No, I wouldn't be there tonight. She used to say, this is the one great thing here. They are frank, they are honest. But mostly she existed on welfare. She wasn't well. She had no discipline. My sister wanted contradictory things, to be a good practicing Muslim and to be a news anchor on CNN. But she couldn't get out of bed. There were months when Hawea didn't seem to wash her clothes or clean her dishes. She would grow plump, then scarily thin. Showering once a day seemed to cost all her energy. Sometimes she would lie in bed for 3 days on end without getting up. Suddenly, she would have a series of bright months in which she could be generous, interesting, tell funny stories. She would have energy, attend class, impress her teachers. But just as suddenly she could turn rude, harsh, low, and would sink back again into lethargy and outbursts of crying. By the early months of 1996, Hawea began saying things like, "Please turn the mirror to the wall." I would ask why, and she would say, "When it faces me, I see things in it." I would yell at her, "Stop making yourself crazy. Get a grip on yourself." But she started sleeping with the lights on. She would call me to come and see her. She needed me, now, right away. But when I arrived, after traveling for hours, she would dismiss me, saying, "I can't bear company now, so go." I wasn't a hermit in Leiden. I saw my friends in Ada quite regularly and gradually made new ones. Geeske was a first-year political science student like me and had a vivid energy. She used to take me to the cinema and student cafes, which were more relaxed than the pubs in Ada, though no less crowded and smoky. But now that I could understand people, I enjoyed them more. People sat outside and ate and listened to music. It became a kind of joke that I didn't drink alcohol. The first time I finally did, I felt woozy and the room swayed. There were no thunderbolts of any kind, but it was far too late to cycle home to Chantal's place, and I had to stay the night with another friend of mine, Evelyn. When I woke next morning, I felt I had crossed a horrible line from stretching Allah's rules to really breaking them. I didn't think Chantal liked me coming home late to her house, and I felt awkward about inviting friends there. Meanwhile, Geeske lived with 16 other students in a vast, run-down old canal house, and she was always talking about how much fun it was living there. When a room in her student house became free, Geeske suggested I apply for it. She told me I would never understand Holland if I didn't experience student life properly. There was a whole selection procedure. All the people who lived in this house got together to interview the candidates over a bottle of wine. They asked us what kind of music we liked, what we liked doing on vacation, what were our hobbies, what kind of student jobs we had. I said my hobby was reading and I had never been on vacation. All these kids were young, all of them were white, and most of them had lived in the same house all their lives. They asked me where I had lived, and just listing the countries, Somalia, Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia, Kenya, I saw their eyes widen. When I said I was an interpreter, one boy said, "Whoa, you must earn a ton of money." I said, "Yes, I did." Geeske was frantic that her housemates would find me boring, or weird, or, worse still, old. But she lobbied them so hard that they chose me anyway. So I moved into a tiny room in a Dutch student house, a place I would share with boys, where there would be alcohol, perhaps even drugs. I armed myself with courage. I moved to Geeske's student house in March 1996. Before I fell asleep that first night, I had managed to get all my furniture into my new room except for my desk, which Chantal had given me. It was large, old and beautiful, and it wouldn't fit in the door. So the next morning I got up early to try to take it apart with a screwdriver. I was underneath this desk in my yellow pajamas when everyone headed off to class. One, an older boy called Marco, put his head under the desk and introduced himself as he headed out. At lunchtime, when Marco reappeared, I was still under there, still in pajamas. In between, I had done 3 phone translations, but of course he didn't know that. He said, "It can't be true. This is unbelievable. Get out of there." And he got the whole thing neatly taken apart in 15 minutes. Then he moved it into my room, put it back together again, and admired my computer. Then my phone rang for another translation. As he left, Marco invited me to have dinner with him that evening in the kitchen. He explained that the people who lived in the student house often shopped and cooked together to save money. "As long as there is someone interesting in this place," he said, smiling. I was tired of all these 18-year-old know-it-alls. Marco was a year older than I, and he worked. He was a reporter for a Dutch science magazine. He had lived in this student house as a biology student. After he graduated and found a job, he stayed on, though he wasn't supposed to. Rents in Leiden were very high. Marco, like so many Dutch people, loved traveling. He spent all his spare cash on long journeys to exotic places like Egypt and Syria. We took to having dinner together several times a week. I went on working, but it was more fun now that I was surrounded by other young people. Still, I knew I was strange to them. I would emerge from my room and tell the others what I had just translated, announcing to someone that he had HIV, counseling a woman who had been beaten, and my housemates would be mesmerized. To them, the lives I came in contact with were on another planet. Almost all my housemates had grown up in the same town as their grandparents, sometimes even in the same house. They had very limited experience of the unpleasantness of the world. Another thing about these kids fascinated me. Everything was about the self. What they liked, expressing their style, treating themselves to something they felt they deserved. There was a whole culture of self that I had never known in Africa. In my childhood, the self was ignored. You pretended to be obedient, good and pious, for the approval of others. You never sought to express yourself. Here, people sought their own pleasure just because they felt like it. Marco was handsome, with light brown hair and big blue innocent eyes. There was always a smile in the corner of his mouth. We were interested in each other, not quite just friends, but neither one of us made a move. One summer afternoon, my friend Tamara came to visit me, along with her mother, who was visiting from Canada. The weather was so surprisingly lovely that I invited them up to the roof terrace of our student house and suggested we eat there. Coincidentally, Marco had a friend over too, and he also had hit on the idea of a rooftop picnic. Having a picnic on the rooftop was forbidden. We all ended up eating together in an improvised private feast. As the evening progressed, Marco and I kept getting closer to each other. The attraction between us, which had been latent for months, flared up and released a kind of energy that caught the others too. Tamara's mother pulled out her camera and took a photograph of us. We posed. Marco put his arm around my shoulder and drew me to him. I still have that photo. It looked so natural, as if we had already been together for 1,000 years. And it felt so wonderful, surprising and good. We didn't kiss or anything. We just held hands for a moment and stayed close to each other, talking all evening, as more friends of Marco's turned up. Giovanni, Olivia, and Marcel. But the next day, Marco invited me to a friend's place down the road. He was looking after someone's cat while they were traveling. We bought some groceries and cooked there. We both knew something would happen. Marco was tender and patient. At first, I felt frozen. I felt that Allah and the two angels were in bed with us too, judging me. I was sinning. But it didn't feel like sin. As the months went by, I grew certain that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with this man. I trusted him. Eventually, I managed to peel the angels off my shoulders and pry them out of our bed. Marco and I almost never spent a night apart for 5 years. We were inseparable. We were equals. We laughed together. We were all the other needed. Midway through 1996, I registered at the Housing Corporation for an apartment, and after only 6 months, I received a letter informing me that I was eligible to rent a flat on the Langegracht in central Leiden for only 800 guilders. Marco and I decided to move in there together. We could pick up the keys on January 1. We welcomed the new year of 1997 together with Hawea. She had recently moved to a student house in Nijmegen, 2.5 hours from Leiden, and had begun working for a degree in public administration there. A whole gang of us rented a house on an island off northern Holland for a couple of days. Hawea seemed tense around Marco's friends, but she loved the long walks when the weather cleared. I remember her running along the beach one afternoon, chasing the gulls, her arms waving for joy. I thought she was fine. But a few days later, after Marco and I moved into our new apartment, I received a call from Tamara. Tamara and Hawea liked each other and often met for dinner or a movie. Tamara told me she had called Hawea's student house in Nijmegen to cancel an appointment, and one of Hawea's flatmates told her that Hawea had been taken to the hospital. She had been shouting in Arabic in her room, throwing herself against the walls and the floor. The police had had to smash down her door. Hawea was taken away in a straitjacket. I went to the psychiatric ward in Nijmegen with Marco. My sister looked frightening. Her hair was wild, standing straight off her head. She had been pulling clumps of it out all night long. Her face was almost unrecognizable, and she had a huge wound on her forehead from banging her head on the wall. She had black and blue bruises all the way up her legs and was heavily sedated. I asked, "Were you beaten?" Hawea said, "No, I was throwing myself on the ground all the time, and I hurt myself." When I arrived, she seemed calm, but as she told me what had happened, she started seeing things that were not there. She told me she was hearing voices. She became very blurry and began talking about Jesus in some kind of religious manner. As I sat there, she began talking louder. She got up and began pacing from one end of the room to the other, faster and faster, chanting, "Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar," louder and faster with every step. I couldn't catch her. She just flung me away onto the bed. She seemed to have enormous strength. Two nurses came in. They held her down and gave her an injection and yanked me outside. They told me I had to leave. I could come back the next day to talk to the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist said Hawea was having a psychotic episode, but she was responding well to medication. They would keep her for a week for observation. Everything might be fine. I went to see Hawea every day. Classes, translations, nothing else mattered. And after a few days, she seemed to get better. She went back to wearing a headscarf, and she seemed not to remember what had happened. All she said was, "I was a little off balance. Holland affects me this way." She said she didn't want medication. She was perfectly fine now. After a week, a judge came to the ward to discuss whether Hawea should continue to be hospitalized against her will. She convinced him that there was nothing fundamentally wrong with her. I took her back to her flat and settled her in. But 3 days later, when I went to see her again, Hawea was visibly not all right. She kept muttering under her breath. She was talking loudly again, like a preacher. She took out Sayyid Qutb's book and said, "Ayan, you must repent. Return to Allah." Suddenly she began taking off her clothes. I yelled at her to stop, and she did, looking shamefaced. I said, "Do you realize you are whispering to yourself?" Hawea said, "Not to myself. There is a voice in my head. It keeps on asking me to behave like a child. So I was telling it, now is not the right moment. When Ayan is gone, I will do it." The next morning, I headed straight to the Leiden library. I was trying to figure out what was going on. Over the course of the next few weeks, I came to see that the voice was like a little Hawea, her memories, her feelings about religion as a little child. Her recollections of school and our parents were all swirling around inside her, mixing into her adult life as if they were real. I saw that my sister was ill in her mind. Physical illness is easy to understand. You are sick, you take medicine. But mental illness is frightening. You can't see the wound. Marco was a biologist, so he helped educate me in the chemistry of the brain. I talked to a psychiatrist. Rationally, I could understand it. I told myself, It's a chemical inside her that's unbalanced. My sister is not cursed. It's not because she's been disobedient to Allah or to my mother. But emotionally, I was devastated. My sister was disintegrating right in front of me, and all I could do was watch. I felt helpless and guilty that I had not seen the signs and somehow prevented this illness by providing her with a stable, supportive environment. Hawaya was not made mentally ill by Islam. Her delusions were religious, but it would be dishonest to say they were Islam's fault. She went to the Quran seeking peace of mind, but the unrest inside her was chemical. I think perhaps it had something to do with the limitlessness of Holland. She used to say it was like being in a room without walls. One time she told me, I was so used to fighting with everybody for every little thing, and suddenly there's nothing to fight for. Everything is possible. In Europe, Hawaya lost her roadmap, and the lack of guidance became unbearable. Hawaya hid her pills. She became delusional and raved. She thought she was cursed. Late one night, she took a taxi from Nijmegen to Ede to see Hasna, the Somali woman who was a refugee in Ede. Hasna paid for the taxi and put her to bed. But next morning, Hawaya picked up Hasna's baby daughter and refused to let her go. She tried to suckle the child. Now she thought she was Mary, the mother of Jesus. Hasna called the police. There was no choice. They gently pried the baby away from Hawaya and took her to the hospital. She was placed in a padded room where everything was grey and soft and only dimly lit. For a while, I wasn't allowed to visit her. They medicated her again. The drugs leveled her out, but they had side effects. She began walking jerkily, throwing her arms around. She got more medicine. She became lethargic and slipped back into depression. Hawaya stayed in the hospital for 6 months. I visited her constantly. One time I found she already had a visitor, Yasin Musa Boqor, the younger brother of the Boqor who had presided over the clan meeting about me in the refugee center in Ede. This man, who was a prince of the Osman Mahmud, greeted me courteously. He was there to check on Hawaya on behalf of my father and the clan. The news had spread. A few weeks later, the phone rang at my apartment. It was Marco who answered. He turned to me, and I saw that he was crying. He said, "Ayan, this is a special call." I took the phone, and my father said, "Abe, Abe," in a voice like a little girl as I used to. I screamed, "Abe, you've forgiven me." I even flung the phone away. I screamed and jumped and did a little dance around the living room before I picked up the phone again. My father said Yasin Musa Boqor had told him how I had been looking after my sister. He had told my father that any man should feel blessed with such a child. In this country, so grey and cloudy and depressing, here was this young Somali girl, behaving so dutifully, working so hard and studying. The prince had respectfully suggested that my father should forgive me. His voice was tender. I was overwhelmed with joy. It was one of the happiest moments of my life. We avoided discussing the whole issue of my marriage and my flight. We wanted to say only good things to each other. My father told me he was living in Somalia again with his third wife and his little daughter. He said he had everything he needed, but he obviously didn't have his own phone. I said, "I want to call you, and I want you to pick up the phone." And I sent him the money to have one installed. After that, I called my father at least once a month. He said we must pray to Allah to cure Hawaya, but he told her also to take her medication. Hawaya seemed to improve. She was moved to the long-stay section of the hospital and was permitted to go out during the day. I threatened to have her committed again if she didn't return at night as she was supposed to. Over the next few weeks, she seemed occasionally to recognize that she was ill. She said once, "Suffering is so lonely. Nobody can possibly understand what is going through my head." It broke my heart to hear it. But Hawaya insisted that it was Holland that was making her sick. If she left Holland, she would be all right. I knew that was nonsense. If Hawea went home to Nairobi, she would stop receiving the medication that was preventing the terrible psychotic attacks. When she was released from the hospital in June, I moved Hawea into the flat I shared with Marco in the Langegracht. It didn't go well. She had become extremely unpredictable, and I spent all my time persuading her to take her pills. Although Marco was supportive, he and Hawea fought all the time. Both of them were very headstrong. I was torn between my translation jobs, my classes, and the sister I was nursing at home. There was barely any room in my life for Marco, let alone for my friends. Hawea was determined to go home to Kenya. She phoned our mother, who agreed with her. Ma told me, "Of course Hawea went mad in that kufr country. Ayan, you should come home too, before you also go mad." My father, Johanna, and everyone else told me I had no right to prevent Hawea from going back, if that was what she wanted. In July, she left. It was a relief to be able to focus again on my studies, although I felt guilty to admit it to myself. I had fallen behind.